Welcome to the Urban Complex, a system of interrelated, emotion-charged ideas, feelings, memories, and impulses. This name takes the definition and lays out what a listener should expect. A podcast where ideas, feelings, and memories collide, leading towards meaningful change. I'm co-host Chris Richardson. Please enjoy the journey with the Urban Complex. Smarter cities for a stronger tomorrow.
All opinions by Chris Richardson, Dominic Poppin, and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Arizona State University, the Arizona Department of Education, or the Arizona Commerce Authority. Any endorsement of or messages from sponsors are solely supporting the production of this podcast. There is no relationship further than podcast purposes with any sponsor unless separately created with another entity. Enjoy the Urban Complex. Smarter cities for a stronger tomorrow.
All right, Dom, here we are. Time for another episode. What's new? What's going on with you?
Yeah, besides being extremely hot, I'm actually down on the ASU Tempe campus today. And I had to come here for a couple of in-person meetings, but it is also move-in week or day or something because it is packed down here. But it's so fun to see all the parents with the big carts moving in their their students. There's a buzz and it's really exciting. I'm actually in the engineering building, so right on College Avenue. So it's just fun to see that kind of buzz back on campus.
Yeah, no, I kind of missed it. As you all know, my role's changed. I'm now with the Arizona Department of Education, but I did go this year because ASU hosted the superintendent of schools, Kathy Hoffman, at Dreamscape on Friday, and I was able to go, and Dr. Crow kicked it off and it was amazing. And you're right, like, parking was just a mess because all the moving was going on too. So I think everything's gearing up. So hopefully that all goes smooth. I know it's a hectic year for ASU, or hectic time of year for ASU. I know the superintendent sent some stuff out. My kids went back to school 2 weeks ago. So yeah, it's that time of year.
Yeah, talking about gearing up for smart cities, pedestrians, COVID, it is
parking.
A living city right now. That's for sure.
Parking, transportation. Yep. For sure.
Great.
All right. So how do you know Aaron, our guest for today?
Yeah. Aaron Carr Jordan, head of social impact. And then also going to become the new digital equity director for the new Digital Equity Institute. We're standing up to really help kind of revolutionize the model for service delivery around digital equity for communities in Arizona. So was connected to Aaron through Lev Gonick, the CIO of ASU, as just a preeminent leader in the digital equity and inclusion space. He's doing some terrific work, not only in Arizona, but actually across the globe, which I think we'll kind of dig into today. So I've been working very closely with her for over the past month, building out the structure of what Arizona in the future of digital equity will look like. So excited to have her on, talk a little bit about her story, how she got to where she's at, but then also kind of give a sneak peek of what we're working on behind the scenes.
Yeah, you know, and you obviously know her a lot better than I do. I know I was introduced to her in one or two meetings at ASU, but all digital during the time of COVID. So I don't really know her well, but it's really exciting what's going on. I can't wait to hear what she has to say. I know that she's similar in kind of a mindset and big thinker like Joshua Edmonds, who we had on. So it's been great to see that continue on. So. What do you think?
Yeah, let's get her on. It's going to be good.
Yeah. All right, cool.
That's it.
Support for this episode of The Urban Complex comes from Worldwide Technology.
What if we could connect people to new possibilities, turn thinking into a way forward, solve problems before they become a problem, and share the future with everyone? We can. At WWT, we connect businesses to technology to make the impossible possible. To reach better decisions faster, to accelerate progress. Together, let's make a new world happen.
All right, Aaron, let Chris and I give you a big warm welcome to the Urban Complex podcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Aaron.
Absolutely. Hi.
Yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun. I know we've been able to work together for a little bit now, but happy to get your story out and onto the Urban Complex for our audience. So what we love to do just to kick it off is before we dive into kind of what you're working on now, you know, your role as head of social impact, tell us about your story. Our goal for this podcast is to understand the people behind the stories. And so please take your time, tell us about your background and essentially how you got to become the head of social impact. We'll dive into that role in a little bit, but tell us your story. What's your background?
Sure, absolutely. And thanks so much for having me. It's nice to get the opportunity to talk to both of you. This is pretty cool, so thanks. Erin Carr Jordan, head of social impact at ASU. Interestingly enough, I come from a long line of academics. So I was sort of destined to be in academia in some way. And I further was destined to be at ASU in some way. My mom started working at ASU when I was 3 years old. So I literally grew up on ASU campus.
Preordained on two fronts, huh?
You know, I always joke, like, I was under her desk while she was teaching, you know, her grad students. And, you know, when I finally got old enough to like walk and run away, I would take my roller skates and go between Farmer and Payne Hall. And, you know, it was like just this deep, deep connection to ASU that I've always had. So I have, I'm a triple alumna of ASU. So my bachelor's, my master's, and my PhD are all from ASU. And then I started as faculty once I got my degrees. And I'm an educational psychologist by trade. That's what my PhD is in. So in other words, I study why people do what they do and try to figure out ways to use that to make sure that their learning experiences are the best that they can be and understand the things that impact them most and create systems where everyone has equal opportunity to thrive. I have long been an advocate for, I don't even know if it's appropriate to say it like this anymore, but the little guy, you know, the person, regardless of gender, who couldn't stand up for themselves, and have been tried to be a champion for all things equal opportunity in every way that we use to define equality and or equity. And so I was faculty at ASU for a little while, taught grad school, and then I was recruited to go be the chair of the grad psych department at another university. So I did that for a while, and then I was an associate dean. I did that for a little while, and then I got just slightly burned out on academia, and I ran away. And I started a research and advocacy firm that work to protect kids and kids' health. And so I did a little writing of legislation, you know, testified before Congress, worked with state, local, you know, legislators to make sure that what they were crafting for use in their respective states took kids and their health and environmental health into consideration. And we did some, you know, advocacy and all that great stuff. And then I started a tech company, and it's a tech company. It's a mental health tech company focused on, kids and teenagers, neurotypical and neurodiverse. So I sort of have been doing those things and all the while, Ed Pless and Phil Regeer reached out to me and asked if I would be willing to, join the team. And I said, absolutely. And I came in and we talked about this role, which is head of social impact, which, you know, if you think about social impact, right, what does that mean? Like social people, right? And impact, what is the thing that you're doing and how does that resonate or impact or change the people that you're intending to do something for, whether that's a program or a practice or a policy or something like that. So it really was, how do they and how do we take into consideration in all of the things that we do, you know, how it's going to land and what the long-term ramifications are. And more importantly, how do we undergird that with this idea that we want to do the most amount of good that we can for the largest amount of people for the longest amount of time? And so that's really what I do now. And I'm super, super lucky. So I get to, you know, work in this crazy transdisciplinary way to look at policy and technology and human beings and how do we weave all of it to create really cool, scalable systems that do a lot of good.
Wow. Such an amazing background. Kind of full gamut, academia, startups, Ed Plus is a very unique organization. It's not traditional academia. I guess I'll have to call you Dr. Jordan there. So there's your PhD props. Congrats on that.
I used to tell my students to call me Dr. J.
All right, we'll stick to Aaron. It makes me more comfortable anyways. Right on. Unless one day, I guess we're kind of getting educated here too, so I guess we are back to Dr. Jordan.
No.
Tell us a little bit about your work with the United Nations. Sounds amazing. You didn't reference that in the background.
Yeah, so, you know, I started working with the UN kind of by happenstance. It was when I was with the other university, and I had started my own company. It was the research firm. It's called Kids Play Safe. We, as an organization, wanted to sponsor another group that was going to the COP. And in this case, it was COP21, which everyone knows as the where the Paris Agreement was signed. That group, the CEO reached out to me and asked if I wanted to come to the COP. And I said, yes, absolutely. I want to go do that. And so we went, and while there, you know, talk about a historic, you know, event. This is where, you know, 193 nations came together and all agreed that we want to make the world a better place, right? And how would we work collectively to do that? And so for me, it was just this really pivotal and inspirational moment that has sort of been now I try to weave into everything that I do. So I became a signatory of the UN Global Compact, which is business entities saying that on behalf of their business, and in this case, I'm the CEO of that business, saying yes, as an organization, and yes, as the CEO, my company will work towards advancing the Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs, which were born out of that COP. And then subsequently, when I started working at ASU, they opened up a higher education version, and ASU started working more deeply with the Global Compact. So now, both in both capacities, I actually go and attend things and have both organizations listed. And for a while, I listed ASU with me because there wasn't anyone. It was before many universities were really engaging deeply with the UN or with the UN Global Compact. And the Global Compact really is this just big consortia of businesses all around the world, from Microsoft and Intel and, you know, nonprofits. I'm sure
you're any university is going to go big with the UN, you know, it's going to be ASU, right?
Absolutely, 100%.
Good time.
And now it's incredible. You know, my work primarily centers around a couple of the goals, which is SDG 3, which is good health and well-being, SDG 4, obviously quality education, SDG 5, which is near and dear to my heart, and almost all of my work in some way touches on it. It's gender equality and the empowerment of women and girls, SDG 9, which is innovation and infrastructure, SDG 10, which is reducing inequalities, which is central to the things that we're talking about for digital equity and making sure that everyone has access regardless of all of the different variables that could potentially preclude their access. And then 13, which is climate, and then 17, which I think is the most important one, which is collaboration for the goals. Or partnership around the goals. And so we have a couple different big projects right now that we work with for the UN. I think the one, there's a couple that are, well, I don't want to say my favorites, but ones that I'm most proud of, if being proud is an okay thing to be. We partnered with the Interparliamentary Union, the World Bank, the Council of Women World Leaders, UN, UN Women, and several other organizations that work in that same space to create this training for SDG 5 for heads of state and parliamentarians. And basically it is, you know, how do we understand the current issues that are impacting women and girls? And then how do we help to make people who might not normally be aware of the SDG and all of the different pieces and potential discriminatory law that negatively impacts people? Go ahead.
I was going to ask, like, I'm assuming there's supplementary documentation for all the sustainable development. Like, where would our listeners go? Hopefully they don't think they're going to get tested as you just rattled off all, you know, the different segues.
Sorry about that. Yeah. So we actually have an SDG site, and we have an SDG 5 portal that's on the Global Future site where can actually look at the training. The training, we actually put it into a 5-video series, so it's super accessible. Anybody can take a look at it. That's there. And then the other piece that we did was I worked with some students at Luminosity Lab to build some new tech, which is super cool. That takes the Universal Periodic Review, which is this big thing around the world where basically it's sort of like, how are you doing? It's basically the world's thing. How are you doing at making things better from a legal standpoint? What laws are still on the books that make it harder for women to equally thrive in this case? So we took that, we undergirded or we created it as a timeline and then worked with the World Bank, which has this super cool thing. It's called Women, Business, and the Law. It's a database of every country that signed CETA. I know I'm saying a whole lot of stuff, just stuff that did that. And we created a notification system that anyone can sign up for. And it basically tells you 12 months, 9 months, 6 months, and 3 months in advance of your review, how you're doing. And it creates a comparison because nobody likes to be compared to other people. It's a great motivator, right? It's one of those intrinsic motivators that encourages change in the coolest of ways. So we used all that together to say, hey, this is how you're doing as it relates to your neighbors to the north, south, east, west. Here's when your timeline is coming up for review, when you have to go before the world and say whether you're doing great or things are potentially challenging still, and encourage people to make change. So we're sort of nudging our way to making true impact in that space. We've got the tech, we've got the training that's specific to that. And then there's other projects that I'm really, really grateful to be part of, like the SDG and Beyond Task Force, which is all around the SDGs and the UN and some other things. So it's one of the greatest gifts of the work that I get to do. And I get to attend like ANGA and the High Level Political Forum and Making Global Goals Look or Business. And, you know, I think in my opinion, and it's just my opinion, to feel free to disagree, it's not until we're sort of crosswalking all of these different disciplines and all of these different viewpoints that we can really see where our blind spots are and try to figure out ways and start to work collaboratively to make meaningful change. Because we've all only got, you know, so much skill, and it's in a very specific space, you know, and if I acknowledge my shortcomings and I leverage yours, then together we can actually move mountains, which is pretty cool. So I think that's one of the great things. Go ahead.
No, that's just what I think is really fascinating about it. And, you know, a lot of our listeners are city managers, CIOs, kind of leaders, even mayors, leaders in this space. But sometimes these challenges are so difficult. They're so interwoven. They're so complex. And, you know, I was just amazed about, as you were rattling off the partners and the work that you were doing, it's the ability to be comfortable to leverage kind of the best and the brightest, either within your community or without your community, to really help you drive towards specific outcomes, right? And because can you also talk about, you do sit, for instance, you know, how does a mayor establish one of these, maybe not at the scale, but even within their own communities, leveraging kind of the universities, the academic institute, whatever it might be, bringing people together to help solve complex challenges. You also sit on some sort of board for the governor of Arizona, right? Governor Ducey. Can you talk a little bit about that? So the way I'm trying to picture it for the audience is, you know, here's the UN that has obviously massive connections, massive resources, massive network, but then you can start to actually build the model down smaller for a governor or a mayor to set up this. Can you talk about what the governor of Arizona has done?
Sure. So that in particular, I sit on the board of, it's the Developmental Disabilities Advisory Council. So that's for awesome. Me is work around people with intellectual or physical diagnoses, disabilities. And I've done that work since I was 18 years old. Wow. You know, for example, on that board, part of what we do is get stakeholder feedback. I think the you know, I'll put it like the openness to have systems where feedback can be provided, but more importantly, to have feedback loops where that feedback is heard. It's used to inform policy decision making. You know, all of those things, to identify gaps and barriers, and then to find, test, fail, iterate on, you know, solutions to take things back out to the community, to stakeholders, to people. Whatever form that happens to be, again, going back to the idea, whether it's policy, program, practice, or anything like that. I think it crosswalks all of the boards. It crosswalks all of the programs that are coming out of, whether it's a city or a state you know, the idea that you can have people who you purposefully bring together. To do that, though, requires one very, very important thing, and that's, you know, relationships, trust. It is all built on, you know, can I trust you? Do you trust me? You know, and can we collaborate? And that means you show up and you nurture those relationships, and they're long-term and sustainable and lasting. And to do that means that, it's, you know, it's like woven into the core of what you want for not just yourself. It's thinking, you know, what do I want for the community? What do I want for the people who live here? What do I want, you know, and constantly showing up and thinking about how you build and do and create collectively.
That's powerful. I think that's a great piece of advice for, you know, we're seeing a lot of transitions in these roles, whether it's new mayors obviously coming in off elected election cycles, or city management is really starting to turn over, whether they call it the silver tsunami in local government, where everyone's starting to move out. And so new administrations are coming in. And so I think this idea of setting up advisory boards, leveraging relationships in the communities to help you, so you're not making important decisions in vacuums. I just love this idea. And when I saw it on your resume, I just wanted to kind of touch on it as a model for other mayors. If you're wondering, how can I really hit the ground running? Maybe it's setting up some of these advisory councils to, again, get that feedback loop really started and helping you as you're making policy decisions.
And you probably know people in your field around other locales too. So if people reach out, they can ask you, and you might even give some local ideas, right? Okay, great.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think it's really important. And we talk about local to global and back again, right? So everything that you do can be individual, community, you know, city, state, domestic, you know, global. I mean, it's the ideas are infinitely scalable. It's just the idea, as long as you're thinking about the thing that you want to do and how it positively or potentially negatively impacts the intended user or the recipient, then, you know, as long as that lens stays applied to all of it, then you're building it accordingly. And then it becomes infinitely scalable as long as you're doing it the right way.
So true. All right, Aaron, so now we're going to have to ask you a really hard question. I know we brought you as an academic onto a Smart City podcast, and we love to have the running joke, right? you knew it was coming. But what is interesting, especially because what we're doing, I mean, we've had a lot of guests on recently where it's Artie in Atlanta or Joshua Edmonds up in Michigan, who are really focused on, you know, you can't have a smart city that's not equitable, inclusive, right, and equal for all. And so I'm excited to, you know, with your background in equity, inclusion, gender work, you know, what is your idea of a smart city? What's your view of a smart city? What do you see that is working, and maybe what do you see that is not? And no worries, no pressure. We won't hold
no pressure.
The answer against you.
The future of the world depends on it.
It's on.
Man, this is one of those where, you know, I can give you my answer from my lens, but it seems like every single person is going to have a different answer. Hopefully it's always centered around data. It's always hopefully centered around anonymized data that's just constantly feeding and informing, so that, you know, whomever is the owner of the data, whether it's a city or a region, is using that data to make sure that the systems are doing good, and increasing efficiencies and, you know, in my opinion, increasing sustainability. So it's, you know, data for all things. It's a loaded question.
Totally. It's usually the hardest one, because you just can't put, I mean, there is no, in my mind, at least, there is no permanent definition. I mean, it's continuously changing, evolving. I think, I can't remember who said it, but we're not going to wake up one day and our city's smart, right? There's no end goal to this. It's to your point. And I like it, leveraging data to continuously innovate and move the city forward and solve new challenges. So
I was thinking about it. Nope. Like, you go to, have you been to CES?
Of course, yes. Okay, yeah.
So I always think about it like CES. You walk in and the smart city section is like, you know, like this whole building, right? It's a whole building. And it's everything in there from, you know, like healthcare and education and data and, you know, IoT and how, like, it's all woven up into the same thing. So it's how do you make sure that you're capturing, although I'm not a fan of that word.
Yeah.
But how are you capturing those data and using them to make good decisions. I mean, and that's exactly the whole thing.
Well, it's also interesting just to go a little deeper on your United Nations work. You know, I'm doing some research. You've got me thinking about all these sustainable development goals. Yep. I like how they're all broken out into elements that actually can provide guidance to what success could be on a number of parameters. And if you think of that with your view on data, you know, goal number one is about poverty. Goal number two is the specific side of food insecurity. Goal number three is just how do you have a healthy lifestyle? So it's interesting how you probably don't even think necessarily those are smart city initiatives, but they really are. And they're, but each of them in a unique angle. And you know, we'll have to include this School for Futures site because they're all right there with a bunch of subsequent detail. I think there's 17 of them. So yeah, I mean, that's a great way to kind of look at it.
And I think, Chris, you just touched on a really important point. Well, two of them, actually. The targets and indicators that are part of the SDGs, right? They're intended to be measured. They are intended to be assessed regularly to understand how you are making progress towards the goals, right? That's one.
Well, and they're tangible. Like a lot of smart city stuff is too high level. It doesn't really mean anything to anyone.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then the second is they are deeply intertwined. So they're not intended to sit in silos, right? So quality education deeply impacts poverty, right? So whether a person has access to education will have a generational impact on their family. Same thing, you know, innovation. They're all deeply intertwined. True. And so they none of it exists in a vacuum. It's always intended to be. And most groups, organizations, business and industry, they don't focus on a singular or one or two goal, or excuse me, they don't focus on all 17. They pick one, two, three, four, sometimes five. I've not seen many more than that ever. But those are the things at which they are very good. And they focus on those because they can have the greatest impact on those. And that is the thing that they do, and they move it forward. And if they're collaborating with others, oftentimes they dovetail around their gaps, which makes a tremendous amount of sense, which goes back to the whole collaboration idea. How can we actually move the needle, right? It's by, working with, instead of doing the thing that is, you know, dissimilar to what we are experts in or our area of expertise, we work with another group who is an expert at that. So then you save all the time that's associated with that. You don't have to upskill people. I mean, it's how you move mountains.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And it's a perfect segue actually into what, you know, Aaron, you and I have been working on with digital equity here in the region and in the state of Arizona. You know, so we've been working closely, to your point, to kind of reimagine and disrupt the service delivery model for digital equity in the communities here in Arizona as part of this Digital Equity Institute, right? So through this 501c3, the goal is to provide digital equity innovation as a service to the cities. So to your point there, you know, leveraging a city, leveraging someone else's whose maybe specific skill set is in digital literacy, digital equity, digital inclusion, and specifically that kind of service delivery. So leveraging this Digital Equity Institute to provide an innovative digital equity innovation as a service to, you know, minority and underserved communities and those that are unconnected to really help them. And there's three kind of prongs: the equip, the skill, and the technically support. So it's really interesting to see this kind of come together here. So tell the audience a little bit about kind of what you're most excited about, and then we'll kind of deep dive into some of the specifics around digital literacy and skilling that you're really working on.
Sure. I think, well, you just touched on, you know, each of the pieces. If I'm being honest, what I'm most excited about is helping kids. And that's the thing that is nearest and dearest to my heart. I think that every single child should have the opportunity to achieve their fullest potential. So in order for that to happen, they all have to have equal access to all of the things that help them along that journey. So if you are passionate about something, you need to be able to learn more. And you often can't do that unless you have access to the knowledge, the content, the things that undergird all of that. So for me, it's making sure that every kid, regardless of race, ethnicity, gender, ability, preference, all of those other things that make up our social identity. Absolutely none of that, including socioeconomic status, and actually primarily socioeconomic status. None of those things should in any way limit your potential. And so for me, being involved in this is a way to make sure that from the earliest age to the oldest age, you know, from a lifespan development approach, it's my master's is in human development and lifespan development. How do you understand what is needed across the entire spectrum? And how do you make sure that anyone who needs it has access to the learning content that gets them to wherever they need to be? So for me, that is a great leveler of the playing field. It is the greatest equity driver of our time. So I'm tremendously excited about having even the smallest of part in that.
Yeah, and this is awesome. I'd love to double click here and really try to tease out the challenge around this digital literacy, right? Because you touched on it there, because it's hard for cities, it's hard for city managers, CIOs, mayors that are trying to say, hey, I want to build a digital equity program. I want all of my community to be digitally literate. Mm-hmm. But you know, a city is not like a private industry partner that can take care of 20% of its market and be happy, right? If they have to help 100% of their market, which means the differences in communities and where they're at in age or where they're at in skill means that you can't have a one-size-fits-all digital literacy program. And so talk a little bit about it, especially leveraging what the education psychologist part of it about how, you know, what are the important aspects to be considering as a city you're rolling out a digital literacy program. What are some of those things that you need to be aware of, because you can't have a rubber stamp program that's going to work for everyone?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, there are things that can be identified and are replicable that are efficiencies that you can pick up and plug in across any state, right? And the first step is the connectivity piece. But once you get people connected, they also need the actual devices to be able to engage online, and they need to be well equipped to do so safely, and to do so in a way that actually gives them access to those things that help them achieve their goals. So if we're talking about a kiddo, we're talking about how do we do our homework? How do we engage with our classmates, right? How do we engage with the sense of community that helps us feel more comfortable and confident in being an online learner? If I am an adult, how do I make sure I get access for myself and for my family to healthcare services? How can I engage in telehealth so that I'm not putting off things that need immediate attention? How do I make sure that the information that I'm seeking as it relates to any of those things is good quality factual information? And how do I become skilled enough to discern the difference in those things? How am I making sure that anyone is prepared to thrive in the workforce of the 21st century? That's a whole different set of skills that people are right now accessing using the internet. You know, some people can't get to by nature of where they're physically located or some other variable.
If you have any, you've got me super excited. I don't know if you've seen, but I'm actually now with the Arizona Department of Education. And they had a tech task force put together a bunch of recommendations because of the pandemic. And they've asked me as the CIO there to create a program to do just that. First, we have to create the communities of practice so that we have an engaged set of IT departments across the state, which we don't, unfortunately, have a great track record. Most of them have their own autonomy. They operate very individually, which is fine. But if we can bring them the best resources to help these areas that haven't really been muscle that K-12 schools have built at Arizona, it'd be great. So if you have specific things that have worked, I know I've talked to a few of our colleagues at ASU because, you know, tremendous things happen through ASU Sync and whatnot. Yeah. So I'm all ears if you want to follow up with it. But
yeah,
it's needed because we're in a new paradigm where the capabilities are there, but the tech isn't necessarily there, and it's not as well understood yet because it's so different. And so this is exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And yes, definitely. And that gets into the exact point that we've been touching on through all of this, right? It is, how do we make sure that everyone is connected, that we are deeply listening to the community, You know, you just touched on K-12. We have to make sure that we're engaging all the K-12 schools, that we're engaging anchor institutions, that we're engaging the community college system. In Arizona, we're so lucky that we have this massive MCCCD system and the PIMA system. And they have workforce programs that they have operationalized that are deeply, deeply woven into the community. We have these three public universities that are, you know, across each of their regions are doing wonderful, incredible work, you know, with the community again. So it's, how do we create a space that is all aligned around this goal of digital equity? You know, equity, how do we define, first of all, digital equity? How do we get everyone, you know, talking? And then how do we figure out how to make sure that we understand what currently exists, sort of assess what's already in our toolkit? I used to call it an arsenal, but people found that off-putting. So like, what do we already have in our toolkit? What are we missing? And how can we get at it, you know, through what already exists and we might not know about? And then how do we make sure that we're deploying it, pulling the right lever for the right group, using the right resource? And a lot of that is just making sure we know what's already happening so that when you, as the guy working for Phoenix who cares deeply about this, so that we can leverage that for use in Apache Junction or Mesa or Peoria or wherever it is, so that every person, and I mean it like that, every person who needs something as it relates to this space can get access to what they need. And that's going to be like curricula, it's going to be citizen services, it's going to be, you know, training, it's, you know, all of the above, because we know that the problem it's digital inequity we're trying to solve for. And these things have persisted for generations. And it's not until, you know, we sort of come in with we have to completely reimagine this using the tools that we already have and start leaning into the human side of it, in my opinion. And, you know, I think, Dom, one of the things that we've talked about is this digital navigator core, right? Yeah. How do we create generational systems where we have young people helping older people, where we have young people helping fellow young people? And, you know, how do we sort of take this idea of true community, find things that, you know, like a call center, for example, where people can call in, get their questions answered. It's an easy thing. But then for those things where it's not a call, you really need a human to walk you through it, that we undergird it with the human piece of it. And the only way to do that is to create human connection and to find ways to set up efficiencies like the call center, the navigator core, and then to find the things that can be specialized based on community needs that are truly culturally responsive. Because in Arizona in particular, one of our greatest strengths is this diversity, right? We have a tremendously diverse state. And in my opinion, that is really important to who we are. And we have to be culturally responsive to all of those differences and not intend to change any of that, but to make sure that whatever is built that is, you know, designed to address inequities, that it meets the needs of the specific community with whom we're working. So to your point, Chris, yes, yes, and yes. I mean, it's just a matter of getting all the right people engaged. Easy task.
Well, exactly. And I took a note on that, you know, when you said human connection, but also I think it was kind of interwoven through all of that. It's human and the organization connections as well. I mean, why the K-12 system, Chris, for instance, doesn't need a child to be solving how to stand up a digital navigator program by themselves, right? Because you've got the libraries trying to figure it out. You've got the cities trying to figure out. And then you can start to leverage those operational efficiencies that you've discussed to actually make these programs more long-term, more sustainable from the very get-go, more scalable from the very get-go, because you have the human and organizational connections, understanding what everyone's doing, what resources you have to leverage. Because I think our biggest worry here, and I know we talk about this all the time, is, yeah, there's going to be a ton of money coming down for these sorts of efforts. However, in the past, we haven't done a great job at building for scale or sustainability. And so how can we build those human and organizational connections to ensure the programs we build today are actually fully scalable and sustainable for the long term? Because we don't want to be here in 5 years, right, saying the same thing. How do we do this? How do we do this? How do we do this? Right. It's our time to do it now. So love that idea about human and organizational connections.
Yeah. And so often things happen in silos, you know, these disparate activities, and there is redundancy where redundancy does not need to exist. And there are inefficiencies where inefficiencies should not exist. And sometimes they can be solved by a conversation, like getting people just into a room and saying, hey, what are you doing? And once you hear what others are doing, you realize you're doing the same thing. And there is best practice in there that, you know, if you collaborate, you can just pick that up and plug it in. And then you are, you know, the pace at which you can get to either deployment or scale is dramatically accelerated just by an awareness of what other people are doing and a willingness to work together.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, it maybe we'll just sneak deep, but I thought, Chris, and you might not know this, but, you know, we found out, you know, the massive tech support system that ASU has internally. And now we're starting to pull them outside the campus to see how they might be also able to provide these sorts of services to newly connected communities. And so it's just to that point.
Yeah, we're exploring the same in Department of Education. In fact, I was just on with a gentleman that is been influencing the New Mexico state system for years. And he was going in front of the legislature today, basically saying, look, there's a law that says they have to provide, based on what happened in the pandemic, they have to provide tech support for online learning, but yet they don't have the capability. And so they're going to get out of this. Each school needs to do it themselves to find some central resourcing to do it at a minimum pooled local levels, if not statewide. And we have to get creative. We have to break down those barriers. And we've allowed a lot of autonomy, which is fine. But there are certain things that can be scaled to do more effectively and still get the right result. So I think the time's now. But
that's great.
All right. Well, Aaron, we do have one question we ask our guests. It's always fun. It often leads us to find great future speakers too. But is there anyone that you're particularly appreciative that's helped you along your personal journey, or that as you've learned about us and the urban complex that you think would be a great guest to have on a future episode? Love to hear a little bit more about that and who you think we should have on the show.
I think you've probably had, you know, two people come to mind. But you probably had her on. Di Bowman is the first person who comes to mind. She's probably
Di would be great. We haven't done a ton of local things because we wanted to build out to some of the other parts of the audience. But yeah, Dom, it is probably time we come back around to Di, who helped us get going in the beginning.
So I say that because Di intersects the overwhelming majority of the work that I do. We work together on policy stuff. We work together on UN stuff, on equity stuff. She does a tremendous amount globally, and she is a true transdisciplinarian. And I think the perspective that she brings is unique and really cool. She's a great human.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We know we've been saying we've had to get Di on the show on now for quite some time because she's doing so many cool things and there's so many, and we were trying to pick which angle we wanted her to come on and talk about.
There you go.
But yeah. Right. So no, this is great. Well, Aaron, this has been a terrific conversation. Thank you again for coming on, talking to us a little bit about your story and then kind of the exciting work that you're doing all over the world. I think this has been a lot of fun. We'll have to have you on again here in the future and just see where you're at and see what kind of important, impactful efforts that you're really helping to drive forward. So, you know, Chris, and I just want to give a big shout of thanks to Aaron Carr Jordan, the head of social impact at ASU. Thank you.
Thank you guys so much.
Thanks, Aaron.
I really appreciate it. Have a good rest of your day.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Greater Phoenix Economic Council, known as GPEC, was named the top economic development organization in the U.S. in 2020. As a data-driven regional organization, GPEC serves as a strategic partner to companies across the world as they expand or relocate to other markets. Over the past 31 years, GPEC has fueled the Greater Phoenix economy by helping more than 850 companies and creating more than 154,000 jobs. Leaders in Greater Phoenix are building the nation's most innovative and connected smart region through The Connective. This community-driven applied research model deploys technology at scale. For more information about GPEC, visit gpec.org.
All right, Chris, that was Aaron. What'd you think?
Well, she's been training for this since she was three. I mean, it's amazing to see. I love it when someone can go so deep into an area. It's pretty awesome. Plus, I love how you said you're back on campus, and we've seen a few people walking back there. So there is signs of life again too. That's great. Yeah, things are changing. I guess I would say with Aaron, you know, you heard me pop up in a few areas. I mean, the sustainable development goals. I mean, I'm always a huge believer that if you can have a vision, but we say here often, if you can think big, but start small, and then find a way to quantify things. Like we've heard so many times how data. And if you've got the goals and it's measurable and you point people in a direction, oftentimes you get stuff unexpected, right? Because people interpret what the development goal is in different ways. But if you have 100 pilots out there and 5 of them hit big and you can quantify them and then you can repeat them, I mean, that's what leads to change. And then the other part is just how much she knows about elements of equity. And, you know, I can't wait. Sounds like she got excited to hear. Sounds like she got some great resources that I can use with Department of Education on figuring out how to align incentives to not only bring some hybrid models of learning instruction, but also just educate teachers and students on how to use them. It sounds like that's where her expertise has been forever. This equity piece is real, and we have to do it in a way that that as many, if not all, can participate. So those were things that jumped out to me. How about you?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. I always get this wrong, and she always laughs. But her background as an education psychologist, it's incredible to see it come through in the conversations we're having with city leaders and school leaders. Because, you know, when you think about, okay, let's get a digital literacy program out there. Let's you know, just develop it and put it out onto the street, and I'm sure it'll be successful. But the ability to sit back and actually think about how you're structuring the program based on the user. I know you always talk about user.
Oh yeah.
User, right? She's thinking, okay, if you're an elderly individual just trying to access your laptop to talk to your grandson, you need totally different skilling than, you know, a student trying to access Blackboard to download their curriculum to then, you know, finish their curriculum. And oftentimes, I think sometimes we just jump into a project very quickly without
thinking. Well, then it becomes academic. It just becomes a bunch of thought leadership. I thought your question early on about how you were asking her how they helped create empathy at a level down from the UN on a local level, I thought that was a really great question, because you can get a mayor to think about how do I create a think tank or a strategic board for this particular topic. And as opposed to just maybe hiring someone that represents it, you actually create a common structure to create empathy for the different, as you pointed out, the different user types, whether it's a elderly population, whether it's K-12, whether it's a segment of maybe English as a foreign language part of K-12. Like, you have to think through these things, and it's harder. You can't be granular. It's hard to do one-to-one for everyone. But if you do have good personas, you can then keep breaking those down over time and get as much canvas as you can.
Yeah, and completely. And I think that's then, to just wrap this up to her last kind of point about the human and organizational connections. It's, you know, if you're thinking about one city trying to develop that just in a silo by themselves and thinking about all those different levels of education and different types of curriculum to different types of people and different types of communities. Well, think about if you can start to partner with your city over here that also is trying to answer those questions, or maybe your school district within your community that's trying to answer those questions at the same time, building those human and organizational connections to ensure that what you're building and what you're deploying can be as successful and as scalable for the long term.
For sure.
Awesome. Well, no, she's great. I'm sure you'll be seeing a lot coming out of Arizona with us. So cracks in the pavement. You've got one for us this week, right? I just saw it.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a doozy. The title is New Orleans Vaccine Mandate for Indoor Dining Takes Effect. Oh my gosh. Like, in this, it talks about how you need to show a vaccine or a negative test within 72 hours of accessing dining, bars, breweries, distilleries, micro distilleries, indoor fitness, indoor entertainment, and performance spaces and large outdoor events. Oh my gosh, talk about a logistic nightmare. But they're saying there's some sort of Louisiana wallet app. Our guest, Laura, there was some stuff with digital engagement that was going on, but she didn't really have a tie-in. So obviously this wasn't on her purview. I know she was focused on transportation, but I've heard New York City thinking about doing their own. I know like Arizona, Texas, Florida, it sure wouldn't be very popular. I just think this is gonna be a really interesting one to see. A, do people get behind it and use the tools to demonstrate they have it, or do they stop going out to places? And B, if they do, does it do anything uniquely different in helping control the spread? It's just gonna be a really interesting experiment. I don't know. Initial thoughts for you? It's amazing that this is where we're headed.
Yeah, to me, I'm starting to think, you know, how are they gonna implement this and execute on this? Because to me, to your point, there's two things. One, are they enforcing the policy and all of the things that come up with that? But then you have to educate people too, because probably the biggest issue is if I'm walking into it and I don't know it's there.
Back to equity. Like, can people use the app? Does it work for the broad population? Can older people use it? Like, it says for 12 years and up. I mean, I think there's a lot of families that aren't sure this thing's ready for their 13-year-old kid to get vaccinated. I don't know. There's just so much to layer it in on this one. It's exciting that they're trying stuff and taking a bold move like this. But, I don't know.
I think ultimately that's the silver lining here. I mean, that's why, you know, we are a bunch of cities are petri dishes for these sorts of efforts. And it'll be interesting. I know a lot of people around the country will be watching to see what worked, what didn't work. And also, I mean, think about how you can maybe port a similar solution or skill or capability that the city now has.
Well, that's what I'm sitting here. You know, I'm very involved and interested in digital engagement. And so I'm sitting here as I'm reading this. I need to get that Louisiana person. I'm going to reach out to Laura, find out who's leading it. And I want to get them on the show to find out, you know, in a month, how effective it was, what worked, did they get the message out? Did people find like it, did they behind it? I don't know, it's gonna be an interesting experiment to watch for sure.
Very interesting, yep, that's great. Well, awesome.
Cool.
Yeah, that's a good one.
All right, well, let's wrap it up. Good to see you, Dom. Thanks all.
You bet, see you next time.
Thanks for listening to The Urban Complex, smarter cities for a stronger tomorrow. Please find us on where you listen, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Do love your feedback. Let us know if you have ideas for guests or questions to air on Cracks in the Pavement via social media. The Urban Complex is found on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. Or just shoot me an email, chris@theurbancomplex.com. Till next time.